Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online, After Midnight.
You can hear it in her voice before you even know the story. That careful lift, the way some syllables hover as if they're trying not to wake the room. She'll tell you she's not afraid anymore, that the noises don't bother her the way they used to. But you can tell that's just a survival trick. It's the kind of tone a person develops when they've had to negotiate with the dark for years. Diana's 15 now. Her choice of words could belong to someone twice her age. She calls the stalking not of this nature. I asked her to say it again because I wanted to be sure I heard it right. Not of this nature, meaning not part of the ordinary world she's been handed. The way she said it, you'd think she was describing the weather in a language only she and the house could understand. She talks as if words are her last reliable flashlight, and she keeps the batteries charged. There's a detail she almost leaves out, a small thing, sharp as a splinter, that doesn't sound important until it slides under your skin. This comes after the attic footfalls, after the floating orbs in their photos, after the night her mother finally saw what Diana had been trying to describe for months. A little boy's head tilting to look, then a dark shape darting down the hall and into Diana's room as if it knew the way by heart. That's when the house changed. You can feel a stranger in a room before you see him. That's how she describes it. The air grew attentive. Like the house had stopped pretending it wasn't aware of them. The bathroom mirror started fogging over even when nobody had showered. Not the faint haze of humidity, but a human breath kind of fog, round and damp, as if someone was leaning close to see her face in the glass. The kitchen lights would dim, not in the stuttery way of a bad bulb, but like the whole room had blinked. Diana began keeping a glass of water at her bedside. She'd wake to find it beaded with condensation, even on cold nights, as though something had been breathing near it while she slept. If you've ever lived in a house that's wrong in ways no landlord can fix, you know that these are the betrayals that get to you. The small domestic physics that stop obeying their own rules. Doors that seem to decide things for themselves. Appliances that greet you like pranksters with straight faces. Cold air settling in spots where warmth should hold steady. And then there's the silence. The worst silence isn't quiet. It's listening. Diana learned early how much to tell her mother and when to keep her mouth shut. In that house, calm was the family's only real currency, and her mother guarded it like a savings account that could never be overdrawn. A single mom with long shifts and more bills than time, she believed in hard work, daylight, and the ritual of locking the door as if that could keep the night out. When Diana would bring up the noises, her mom's voice would sharpen, "Stop putting ideas in my head." It wasn't cruelty. It was math. If the house was haunted, what could she afford to do about it? Exorcisms aren't in the budget, and denial is cheaper. So Diana went inward. She started reading not the cartoon ghost stories passed around at sleepovers, but the ones told in plain voices by people who sounded tired of their own memories. She read like someone preparing for an exam that might come any night. Patterns became her field notes. The sobbing girl she first saw at 9. The bathroom window eye that showed itself twice. The door that slammed in the old house. The blender that whirred cold on a locked counter in another. The Mexico scratching on glass. The blanket that tucked itself politely around her mother's shoulders. The footsteps in heels at 3 in the morning. 2 fingers dragging across her back. The attic above her bed where something invisible learned to pace. She drew mental maps of these things, not because a map would save her, but because it gave her a way to walk the territory without closing her eyes. I asked her what frightened her the most. She didn't say the eye. She didn't say the fingers on her back. She thought about it, then said, "The mimicries." She meant the voices, how sometimes they sounded exactly like her family calling her from empty rooms. How the thing in the house knew which tone to borrow to get close. If you've ever been haunted or even just loved someone you've lost, you know that distance is hard to measure when the dark can wear the voice of someone you trust. How do you guard yourself against a shape that comes dressed in tenderness? It isn't constant terror. That's the other misconception. Hauntings have their seasons. There are weeks when the house behaves, when the only noise is adolescence. Sneakers slapping on tile, a hair straightener hissing in the bathroom, siblings bickering about the last of the shampoo. In those stretches, her mother laughed more. Even the light in the windows felt easier. Then the whir would come back, a knock beneath the knock, something unseen resuming its shift, and the family would recalibrate their shoulders, as if bracing for a storm you can't find on the radar. She told me about Mexico, the trip to visit relatives, the night her mother felt the blanket lift and settle back over her, as though tucked in by unseen hands. That was the one moment Diana talks about with softness. "My abuela," she says. In that telling, the border between worlds thins into a gentle veil. Mexico makes space for the dead in ways the U.S. often doesn't. Rituals as common as grocery lists, offerings of marigolds and bread on a kitchen shelf. But even there, 2 a.m. is 2 a.m., and fingernails on glass are still fingernails on glass. Comfort and warning, braided together. If she came back, it was to cover us, Diana told me. But when she talked about the boy in the hallway or the eye at the window, her tone changed again, like she was switching languages. If this were a tidy story from a tidy house, there'd be a single climactic night that explained everything, something that drove the intruder out or invited it in. But this haunting seems to prefer the edges. It lives in thresholds, the crack of a door, the pause between waking and sleep, the breath before an answer. That's where Diana has learned to live, too, in the liminal spaces. She told me about a night she rarely mentions. Past midnight, her phone face down on the pillow, the room sliced gray by the street lamp outside. She hears her name, softly, lovingly, spoken from the dark near the closet, her mother's exact tone. Relieved and annoyed at once, she answers, "What?" Silence. She tries again. "What?" Still nothing but the sound of her own pulse in her ears. Then, from the living room, she hears her actual mother's laugh, low and easy, followed by the clink of a spoon against a mug. It's a particular kind of terror, realizing the geography you rely on, who's where, who's awake, has failed you. She lay staring at the closet seam, thinking of the attic hatch above it, the crawl space near the bathroom, all the secret compartments a house invents to keep its stories hidden. She didn't wake anyone. She just lay there, bargaining with dawn. You might think she'd grow used to it after so many years. That's not the word she chooses. Familiar, maybe. There's a kind of competence that grows from long exposure, the way a sailor reads clouds without needing the forecast. Diana can tell you the difference between pipes settling and footsteps pressing down on the joists. She knows which stair will creak and how loudly, and how to judge by the weight of a sound, whether it came from her floor or the one above. She can sense if a knock is the house remembering to breathe or something else trying to be remembered. She's even learned to set boundaries out loud. "Not tonight," she'll say into the dark. "Not here." Sometimes the room seems to accept the rule, like a dog respecting the edge of a yard. Other nights, it ignores her. Those are the nights she texts her friends at 1 a.m, ordinary messages with hidden meaning. "You up?" "Lowell," or "can't sleep." If a friend answers fast enough, the house seems to retreat, as if the screen's blue glow draws a temporary border. When nobody replies, she lies there with the phone on her chest, letting its hum remind her she's still part of the living world. A heartbeat in her ears, the weight of her own breathing, those become her stake in the ground. Whenever her family moves, and they've moved more than most, she's the one who checks the corners first. Another kitchen, another bathroom, another small window that faces something too narrow to explain the draft that sneaks in at night. She'll look at a new house the way some people read warning labels. She started taking pictures. At first it was curiosity. Later it became habit. Sometimes she borrowed an old point-and-shoot camera because she didn't trust the filters on her phone. She'd scan the photos later, looking for the currency of this strange economy. The bright disks people call orbs, the smudges that don't belong to light leaks or dust. One picture still lives on her nightstand, three perfect circles hovering just above her face, each bright as if lit from within. Skeptics call it dust. She calls it evidence, something she can hold in her hand when the house starts gaslighting her again. Her mother has started to accept more than she wants to, not willingly, but enough. The day she was stirring soup and caught the glimpse of a small head lean around the kitchen doorway to watch her, followed by the flash of a dark figure slipping straight toward Diana's room, something in her shifted. She still checks the locks at night, still tries to close curtains as if cloth can keep things out, but when Diana mentions a sound or a feeling now, there's a pause before the reply. That pause is new. It's the kind of silence that listens before it answers. That silence has changed their relationship in small, stubborn ways. It's the difference between going to bed alone with your fear and going to bed knowing at least one other person believes you. People always want a remedy. They want a priest or a psychic, a ring of salt, a candle blessed by someone who speaks with authority. They want me, as the storyteller, to hand them a list. Here's what works. Here's how you tell a house to forget your name. But houses have memories, and so do children who grow up inside them. Together, they build their own private history. Diana knows there will be more nights like the old ones, nights when she's bent over geometry homework and hears footsteps begin pacing the attic overhead. There will be dawns when the bathroom door eases itself open just an inch while she's brushing her teeth, like the house is deciding whether to join her. There will be summer afternoons when a breeze dies halfway through the hallway, and the air takes on that too full feeling again. The thoughtful, listening air she's come to recognize as a warning. And then there will be other days, most of them, when nothing at all happens. Days that pass so normally, you almost convince yourself the strange events were just a trick of memory. Those are the days when she lets herself believe in ordinary ghosts, regret, longing, the everyday specters that haunt all teenagers. The Mexico story lingers because it was the one time the unseen felt like family. I asked whether that moment, her grandmother's invisible hand settling the blanket, changed the way she felt about the rest of it. She shook her head. "It's not all the same," she said. "She's learned to sort. This voice is mine. That one isn't. This touch belongs to someone I love. That one doesn't." She doesn't romanticize the dark, but she doesn't demonize every shadow either. "Sorting," she says, "is how you survive. It's a skill they don't teach in school, but probably should. How to draw a line in shifting sand and make it hold." We circled back in our conversation to the first image. 9 years old, seeing the shape of a girl folded into herself in the far corner of her bedroom, shoulders shaking with a silent sob. There are people who'll tell you that every child who sees a ghost is really seeing a piece of themselves. Others will say every ghost is a child who wants to be seen. I don't argue either theory. But I notice how Diana's voice changes when she talks about that girl. The fear slips aside and something else shows through, recognition, edged with a quiet anger. "I thought it was my sister," she said. In that one sentence is a whole education. Your first instinct is to reach toward what feels familiar. Your second is to pull the blanket over your head. Both instincts keep you alive. She calls her sensitivity a gift, though it's not a gift most of us would want. She didn't choose it. She inherited it, the way families pass down eye color or temper. She carries it like a second set of house keys. "The trick," she told me, "is not to jingle them, unless you need to. Don't invite, don't provoke, but don't lie either. The house hates liars. It wants you to tell the truth about it. The truth is a boundary. If this were a story with a neat ending, I'd be giving you one final night that explained everything, a last confrontation that named the thing or drove it out or let it win. But Diana's story isn't built that way. It doesn't want a single scene to tie it up. It prefers the present tense the way the dark does, never entirely gone, never entirely here. She told me about one such night, which feels less like a climax and more like a lesson in living. Nothing special about the date or the weather. She was 15, home on a school night, her door locked, the room muted into that color of pause you get right before you fall asleep. Her mother and sister were talking softly in the living room, the kind of murmur that feels safe. Her brothers had long since gone quiet in the room next door. It was in that lull that the air changed again, gathered weight without moving, the kind of charge that makes your skin remember goosebumps before they rise. She could feel the attention of something unseen settling over her. The start of panic flickered through her chest, quick as the sound of a match head catching fire. She didn't bury her face in the pillow. She didn't cry out for her mother. Instead, she said, barely above a breath, "Not here." Then she did something I found strangely brave for someone her age. She rolled onto her back, laid her arms out wide with palms flat, as if she were making a snow angel, and began to count. Not sheep, not seconds, heartbeats. She gave herself a number, 47, not for any mystical reason. It was just the number she chose, a decision she could own in a room that so often ignored her choices. If she reached it, she'd sit up and switch on the light. If she didn't, she'd stay where she was. She counted all the way to 47. Then she sat up, clicked the lamp on. The room looked ordinary. The glass of water on her nightstand wasn't beaded. The closet seam held no hint of breath. The ceiling was just a ceiling, not a lid pressing down. She stayed sitting for a long while, staring at the ordinary proof around her. She thought of the girl in the corner, the boy who leaned into the hallway, the grandmother's unseen hands tucking the blanket, the fingers across her back, the eye in the window that should have belonged to no one. She thought of the blender that had run cold on its own, of every door that had ever slammed as if the house were making a point. She thought of every move her family had made and every new place she'd had to audit for old shadows. For the first time in years, she felt not triumphant, but quietly in control. She turned the lamp off again. The dark did not lunge. It didn't rush to fill the space, she'd claimed. It simply settled the way a blanket settles once the person beneath it stops shifting. For once, the house seemed to take her at her word. The noises haven't stopped, the house hasn't changed its mind, but Diana has. She still feels watched sometimes, she still hears the subtle sounds in the walls and wonders which of them belong to plumbing, which to memories. But she's fascinated still. She collects other people's hauntings now, reads them the way other kids scroll through feeds, gathering postcards from places she's already been. Her mother has learned to meet her halfway. There's less eye-rolling, more long sighs, more recipes cooked as though food itself were an act of protection. Her father, when he visits, checks the yard with a flashlight as if he's trying to find footprints in soil too hard to hold them. They move forward together in a way that looks like faith, whether or not they'd ever call it that. When I asked Diana whether she ever wished for it all to stop, she didn't answer right away. She thought about it, eyes lowered like she was weighing her own heartbeat in her hands. Finally, she said, "I don't want it to stop. I just want it to know the rules." That sentence stayed with me. It's the right way to end a haunting story, and also the wrong way. Wrong because it admits there will be no clean ending, not the kind you can fold and put away. She's still just 15, stubborn, curious, equipped with a locked bedroom door, a good bedside lamp, and a voice steady enough to cut through a listening room. Somewhere in that house, a floor remembers footsteps. Somewhere in that house, a mirror remembers a face that wasn't hers. Somewhere in that house, a blanket remembers how to rise and settle with the weight of a hand that isn't there. And somewhere, maybe only inches from the edge of her bed, the air is still, quiet, and waiting to see which of them will speak first. If you're listening to this tonight in a room that feels safe during daylight, you may notice yourself paying more attention to the space just behind you. Maybe you're thinking of the window that looks out over a thin strip of yard where footsteps wouldn't leave prints. Or maybe you're listening to the silence and wondering if it's listening back. That's not the story playing tricks on you. That's just you remembering what Diana learned at 9 and relearns at 15. The dark notices us too. It doesn't have to be cruel to be unsettling. It only has to be present. Some gifts, if that's what we call them, teach you how to draw lines that hold. Some teach you how to live beside a thing without letting it live through you. Tonight, Diana lives by her own rules. The house listens. Sometimes it obeys. And as for you, if your room feels a little more attentive than usual right now, it might just be the story settling in.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.
Extra value meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.